big folk are going to look at this matter of affluence. Here we go. I have a personal question to ask you as I begin this morning. You don't have to tell anybody to answer this question. I just want you to answer it in your own heart, not out loud. Do you ever watch People's Court on TV? Is Judge Wapner's picture mounted on your bureau or dresser or bedroom wall? Are you one of those people that loves to watch the litigious spirit of human nature come to full expression and flower in that courtroom? Was there ever a greater spectacle of what human life is all about than all the squabbling and caterwauling and carrying on of shameless people in that courtroom? Was there ever anybody more aptly named than Judge Wapner? I would not believe that people would do the things they do except for that show, but that's human nature, and I want you to keep that in mind as you look at the first verses of the passage that Sage read from a few moments ago. Because we had a man there who was just seething with anger and frustration. He interrupted one of Jesus' seminars to say, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." Would you explain the part about tax-deferred shelters or anything like that? He says, would you just tell him and give him a command to divide his inheritance with me? Here's a man who's at odds with his own brother. I know of somebody who said that if you ever have to divide up things among the family when your parents die, if there's something you really want and somebody else really wants it, let it go, no matter how much you want it, because it can cause grief that lasts a lifetime. So here you have a young man who is steamed at his brother, been eating at him. It was festering and boiling down inside. He was determined to get his fair share. There was no way his brother was going to get away with this dirty deed. He was getting desperate. He couldn't sleep at night. It was consuming all of his attention. And so he puts this thing to Jesus. But would you notice, it's not a question of information. It's not, Jesus, my brother and I are having a dispute. Would you give your opinion on this? It's not even, suppose you had two people. You ever heard these questions? You can see everybody else knows that he's not faking anybody. Suppose you had two people and one had received double inheritance because he was the older, and you had a younger one who was really poor but nice, and the older one wouldn't loan anything to him at all. What would you think about that? What he just does is demand that Jesus simply take his side. There's nothing for Jesus to think about and debate. And it prompts a rather pointed response from Jesus. If you look in verse 14, Jesus refuses to do it. What, do I look like Judge Wapner? I refuse to get into that kind of debate and discussion. But what bothered him more than that was the attitude that he detected underlying that, not request, but demand. And he moves into a statement in verse 15 in which he said to everybody, he takes this occasion to issue a very grave and strongly worded warning. Watch out, he says. Be on your guard. You never know when this will hit you, the disease of greed. The word in the Greek speaks of an ever-growing desire to have more, an unquenchable thirst. That's what greed is. I remember being real little and wondering why people could die of thirst out in the ocean until I grasped that if you drink seawater, it only assuages the thirst momentarily and then it intensifies it, so it's virtually excruciating, and you can kill yourself by drinking seawater. Greed eats you alive like that. That's why it's a strong warning. This is just like somebody saying, don't drink the seawater. It will kill you. It's a strong warning. Must be a reason for it. It must be because every one of us on some level is in danger of that disease. We're all prone to it, and so he warns us. And that's the real problem with affluence that I want to talk about this morning, is how to handle it without succumbing to the disease. The problem, as we're going to see, is not with material abundance. That is not the problem at all, but there's everything wrong with making it the benchmark of our lives, the whole goal and reason for being. That's like seawater. It'll kill you. I want to talk about three types of life. I want to talk about the one Jesus warned about, first of all, the greed life, if you will. A guy named Donald McCullough went to East Germany. McCullough's a pastor, and he got in a heated debate with a pastor in communist East Germany. And the East German pastor said this to him. He said, "You Americans like to talk about freedom and high-sounding ideals, but you should be more honest. What you really value is the power to satisfy your material wants." Well, McCullough hadn't been an American all his life for nothing. You know, he bristled and he stood up to him and gave him a lecture on the American way of life. But he went home, nagging thought inside of him that if he had to live in East Germany, what would bother him was not the loss of freedom, but the small apartments. Cars you had to wait for 13 years that were a miserable excuse for anything, let alone a car. The lines you'd have to wait in, the food that you couldn't get, all the comforts that he was used to. That's what would bother him much more than those ideals. In a way, he felt like maybe that pastor was kind of right. There are two problems. Everything I want to say about the greed life can be summed up in two words. The first one is seductive. The greed life is seductive. It messes up your mind. It distorts your perspectives and values. It becomes the all-important thing in your life. And you know what I'm talking about because you're all red-blooded Americans, most of you anyway, and you live here, and you know that we have a right to abundance, don't we? If we don't have the abundance, if we don't have the affluence, we feel like we're getting cheated, mind you, out of the American dream. Perish the thought that it could be our fault. You know that if workers are denied a raise, they don't get together and say, let's figure out what we can do to increase productivity. We didn't get the raise this time. There must be something we're doing wrong. They get together and talk about how to defeat the capitalist swine, the bourgeois taskmasters who are grinding them down into the dust. Workers of the world, unite! That's the attitude. We all owe ourselves a piece of that dream. Any threat to it throws us into a tremendous tailspin of crisis. 1,600 times a day, the crisis is reinforced by ads that say, you need this, buy me, bathe in me, dress in me, drive me, enjoy me. There's chewing gum now, quote, for the very rich, end quote. There's a billboard that advertises, you have made your success, now live in it, a beautiful house on the billboard. You've seen the glossy ads, you've sat in. I'm glad I got a VCR because now I can fast forward through the shows and watch the commercials. Some of those are the best few seconds of cinematography that has ever been done. You've seen the Clio Awards, you know how those go. They're dazzling. It's hard to sit and watch some seafood buffet with the crab legs. I guess I came through the big open space up there, but you know, even they don't look as good on the table as they do at that sparkly phosphorescent screen where the water splashes in slow motion to some wonderful classical piece of music. And then you go down and rummage around for some Oreos or something of that sort. There's a gap in experience at that point. And we're all surrounded by those messages all the time so that with restlessness and dissatisfaction sneaks up on us. It's not only the volume of the ad, the sheer number of ads with which we're assaulted, but it's that seductive nature. Robert Maynard Hutchinson says that, quote, our real problems in our culture are concealed from us by our current remarkable prosperity, which results from our new way of getting rich. Here's how he says it. This is the way we get rich now. Quote, buy things from one another that we don't want at prices we cannot pay, on terms we cannot meet because of advertising we do not even believe. Oh, you believe in the advertising. Eventually, you begin to stake your very identity on affluence. You've seen the bumper stickers? I love these. Born to shop. Or a woman's place is in the mall. Not my words now. I saw that on a lot of cars. You remember Descartes' dictum, I think, therefore I am? In our culture, it has been transformed. I consume, therefore I am. I stake my existence on that. It's not a new problem. It's always been a particular trait of the American character with a land of boundless opportunity that's been our snare. I suppose other cultures and groups have sins that lie in other directions, but where we get in trouble is in the area of greed. 100 years ago, William James said, the squalid cash interpretation put on the word success is our national disease. Now, the problem with seduction is that it always promises what it cannot deliver. Over and over and over, get out of concordance, look up the word deceitful, and you'll find it very often with the word riches. Riches are deceitful. That is, they seem to sparkle and glisten and promise things that they can never provide. You've seen the advertising, haven't you? My subscription to Consumer Reports lapsed, which is too bad, because I used to turn to the back inside cover first. You know the part I'm talking about? that always has a series of ads, you know, on the new improved candy bar, and really the candy bar is not any bigger, it's just a larger cardboard container inside, which makes the package look bigger and ups the price and all of that. Some of you are nodding with a disgusted look on your face. Yeah, I've been there. That's what, in a small way, is what prosperity and affluence is all about. It promises all these wonderful things, but it doesn't really deliver. In a recent book called The Permissible Lie, the authors spoke of the advertising industry, and I don't mean to tar the entire industry, but some of this goes on. I know you could say the same about ministers, but we're not talking about them this morning. Talking about advertising. True story, in a board meeting where the client comes in and says, we want a splashy, big campaign with lots of promises, a new, improved type of approach to campaign, because we have discovered that our sales are lagging in the area of one of our canned products, and we are jazzing up the can to look more attractive. Now we need a big marketing approach to go with that. And one of the advertising people said, well, have you done anything about what's inside the can? And the man looked at him and glared and said, what kind of a question is that? I'd have told you if there was anything different about the contents, any changes other than the label. That'll be the redesigned product, will look new and improved, won't it? That's the important thing. Whose side are you on anyhow? And it's very interesting, a week later, the advertising man was fired. Had no business, he's not paid to ask those kinds of questions. The deception is that these ads and the glistening glow of affluence, the glitter, says that we need things that we don't really need. When I moved from the north, from Michigan and Massachusetts, where I went to school, into Virginia, the first thing that assaulted me was the humidity and the heat. I just languished in it. You just have to have made that transition to understand what a depressing adjustment that can be for somebody who wasn't privileged to be growing up in Dixie. And I remember that I bought my first car. It was a real sharp Pinto. It had standout white letter tires and a really good stereo. It was hot. It told the world, I'm up and coming. And I remember that it had air conditioning. And I visited my brother, who is still living up in the northern wastelands, and I said, well, you know, air conditioning is a necessity in the South, not a luxury. And my brother was still in college, so he was given to these kinds of statements. Oh, that's not true. That's not a necessity. It's still a luxury. We had a big fight about this. This was shortly after the 60s, so that accounts for part of it, before the whole national temper changed. We had a big debate and argument about it, and I really believed it. I thought, you can say all you want, but I'm living down there, buddy, and I want to tell you it is H-O-T-T, hot. That's kind of interesting because I have an even neater car today, and the air conditioning has been out. I'm completing my third summer without air conditioning in that car. Every time I get ready to fix it, something happens. God slams the door in my face. I won't bore you with the details, but I stand here to tell you that as great as it is, and as important as it is, I am surviving. I'm here. I'm talking to you. I'm alive. So I have to ask myself, what is a necessity? What is a luxury? I didn't think cruise control was a necessity for a long time, but I've learned otherwise, meantime. I'm afraid to get updated in new cars because of all things you can no longer live without. I don't have to beat that drum. You understand how that goes. The tragedy, according to Donald McCullough, is we substitute in place of Christian hope the dreams of this world. Like Don Quixote, clothed in tarnished convictions and astride a nag of uncertain confidence, we are on an adventure of impossible dreams. It's seductive. Secondly, it's destructive. It's as destructive as it is seductive, and that's what this story is all about. Jesus tells a little story to make his point after he warns that our life does not consist in the abundance of our possessions. He tells about a man that's at the top of his field. He's a rich man. He produced a good crop. He is at the top of his field. And so he decides that he is going to build bigger barns to house these bigger crops. And he tells himself, I'm going to sit back and take it easy and enjoy my retirement and maybe do some good things for the Lord and all the rest. And God says to him that very night, you fool. Fool. Now that's a strong word. It's even stronger in the Greek. You fool, he says. Number one, he's a fool because of where his trust lies. His trust is in the material things. As though somehow having bigger barns was going to exempt him from that death rate that is still 100%. 10 out of 10 people die. Did you know that? Latest statistics. But this man thinks, maybe I'll be the exception to that. What if it all burned up tomorrow? Suppose he had those bigger barns and he thinks, I'm secure now for life, but something can happen. Lightning could hit it. One of his employees could get soured and set a match to the thing, and it's all gone. What about changing economic conditions? What about different political administration comes in? What about an invasion from enemies? He was a fool because he put his trust in those things to provide in ways that they can't do. Secondly, he's a fool because he thought he'd know when he'd die. I suppose if we had a choice, we'd all decide to die in our old age in our sleep. But none of us really has a choice, do we? In fact, God says to him in verse 20, you don't even know who's going to get what you prepared for yourself. You got it all for yourself, and guess what? It's going to somebody else, and you don't even know who. That's why he's a fool. Thirdly, he's a fool because he's so preoccupied with the physical, as though that were all there was to life. I know that's what Carl Sagan thinks. He says the cosmos is all that ever was and all that ever will be. But it's not what I think. It's not what Jesus taught. I'll pit Jesus against Carl Sagan any day of the week. And when Carl Sagan rises out of the grave, I'll pay more attention to him. Jesus says that we are much more than physical. And I think most of us sense, even skeptics among us sense, there's something more than just this, just the physical. Now, you know, in Russia, they may be ideological materialists. We are practical materialists. Let me show you the difference and how they are similar. I'll quote you from a writer named John White. Quote, communist materialism is doctrinaire and oppressive. Capitalist materialism is pragmatic and cancerous. One oppresses from the outside, the other eats from the inside. He goes on, communist materialism claims that matter is all there is. Western pragmatic materialism assumes that matter is all that matters. The problem is we are material creatures, and I want you to understand that God made us that way. He's the one who designed material things. There's nothing wrong with those things in themselves. They give real joy and pleasure. They do give some sort of security in a sense. It's limited, but there is some reality to it. That's why somebody like Marx could build an entire philosophical edifice on it. Philosophy of history and economics and politics and everything else. And the frightening thought to me is that some of us who would not think of ourselves as communists at all are still building on basically the same kind of foundation as Karl Marx. That's what this man was doing. So he's a fool because he's preoccupied with the physical. He's a fool because he's overlooking the temporary nature of things. You ought to go out to the city dump sometime and just sit and look at all the discards. The ash heap lives that we live, all the things that look so great and we pay top dollar for and depreciate it, just go by an auto junkyard. Just drive up I-35. Just come by my house. You can see all those glittery things and what they look like way down the road. And he was a fool, lastly, because he thought only of this world and not of the next. Now think about this. It says in 7, we brought nothing into the world, and we can take nothing out of it. Now, if life is material possessions, and we can't take anything out of it, then death looks even worse than I thought. Life consists of material things, and it's all going to be ripped out of our hands. The Christian view, what makes it such good news, is no, that is not all there is, and this life is not all there is, and there is more on the other side. And if we chase the wild goose of material affluence, thinking it'll provide things it doesn't, if we heed the siren call, then we're going to miss the deeper joys, the lasting pleasures, of which the material delight is only a pale reflection. John White tells about being overseas as a missionary and going to dinner one night with a Cantonese importer. He went into this man's room, and he says it was breathtakingly beautiful in his home. He had an artificial tree about 4 or 5 feet high, and he says there were exquisite flowers fashioned from clusters of semi-precious stones that just sparkled on this tree. And they sat down at the table, and he was looking at gold tableware. He thought it was solid gold, but he knew enough to know that it was kind of gauche to ask. So he just acted casual. But he was impressed. And what's interesting is that in the course of the conversation, the Cantonese importer began to comment about spiritual things. And he began to say that he planned to make enough money so that he could spend his closing years doing something for the Lord without being a burden to anybody. And White looked down at this tableware and he thought, this tableware alone could keep me in business with what I'm doing as a missionary for a long, long time. This man wasn't sure he'd actually gotten there yet. He just wanted to be sure he had plenty of billions aside so he could do God a big favor at the end. And the real tragedy, he said, was that this man seemed peculiarly joyless. I mentioned that last week, that when you don't have, you can fool yourself into thinking, if I had it, I'd be happy. But then when you get it and discover that's not it either, you don't want to give it up. You're kind of addicted, but you're miserable because you don't have any hope and you don't know where to look. Anybody who stakes his joy on material things is in for a rude surprise. Let me quote to you from John D. Rockefeller. That's a rich man that used to live in America. I have made millions, he says, but they have brought me no happiness. John Jacob Astor left $5 million, but at the end of his life he said, I am the most miserable man on earth. Henry Ford actually longed at the end of his life for the happier days of being an auto mechanic. Does that cheer anybody up? And fourth, Andrew Carnegie, quote, millionaires seldom smile, end quote, end of story. The amazing thing is, in the midst of all this, you run across this odd person once in a while who has nothing and is thoroughly happy. Sometimes they not only don't have the luxuries, they don't even have some of the necessities, but there's this overflowing joy, and it's a pleasure just to be around them, hoping some of their overflowing cup will just spill upon you. The tragedy is that this kind of view sometimes gets repackaged as Christianity. I've mentioned this several times. You've heard the talks. If you have a Cadillac faith, you won't be driving a Volkswagen Rabbit. If you have Cadillac faith, God is king. He doesn't want you eating chickens one week and the feathers the next. He wants you living high on the hog. He's the owner of the cattle on a thousand hills. Yes. That's tragedy. Watch out, says Jesus. Christian or otherwise, a man's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions. Well, that's the view over here. Then we have those who back off completely to the other side and think, well, okay, we'll get rid of everything. This is what I call the giving it all away life. We have the greed life on one side, the giving it all away life on the other. This one says, a really spiritual person who is trusting in God instead of riches would prove it by giving it all away. Isn't that what happened to the rich young ruler that raced up to Jesus? And he said, what must I do to achieve eternal life? And Jesus said, give everything you've got away. And he went away sad. And we read it, sad. You've got to be kidding me. But some people take that very seriously. They argue that it was Judas's pathetic desire for a few silver coins that crucified the Lord of glory. They point to somebody like Solomon, who was asked at the beginning of his life, Solomon, would you like riches, fame, wealth? What do you want? You just tell me, and I'll give it to you. And Solomon was just embarking on his career as king of Israel. He said, Lord, give me wisdom, because I need to rule your people wisely. And God said, you have asked wisely, and I will not only give you wisdom, but riches and fame and honor and all the rest. These kinds of lessons in the Bible, the fact that it constantly talks about the poor, have actually led to a stream of theological thinking, liberation theology, perhaps you've heard of it, that really argues that it's wrong to be rich. And the rich are the ones that God has come to do away with and to exalt the poor. One modern scholar named Alistair MacIntyre says, quote, the New Testament clearly sees the rich as destined for the pains of hell. Well, that's good news. The Gospel of Simple Living, on the other hand, says that if you're really spiritual, you're going to be a little bit shabby. You're going to be poor, modest. It's better than being wealthy. It proves that you're not hung up on wealth. Is that not your viewpoint? Well, let me ask you, when you see a picture of a starving child, do you feel compassion or guilt? You understand the difference? Because if a lot of us have this little note of guilt, this tinge in there that feels guilty about this starving child. And I want to suggest that compassion is an appropriate response. Guilt is not a particularly helpful response. The guilt shows that in a sense we feel guilty about having. Here's another test. For suppose that in order to use your property, money, and influence effectively for God, you had to live a life that involved an above-average standard of living. Would you feel that you would be holier if you gave it all away? Do you look at somebody who lives without those things and think they must be holier and better than I am? Let me put it another way. Suppose you have a sincere, devout Christian with barely enough money to live on, But on the other side, he cheerfully goes about his business. Over here, you have a Christian businessman who holds on to his funds, keeps what we would call substantial financial reserves on the side, and he goes about his job in an honest and industrious way. He has uses his reserves for good purposes. Which one is more spiritual? Do you ever catch yourself thinking, well, yeah, but he gets a nice car. This guy doesn't get anything. This guy must be more spiritual. That's the giving it all away mentality. I want to suggest that it's not really a biblical perspective on affluence. It's not a helpful perspective. We seem to ping between greed and giving it all away. Delusions of riches are not precluded by not having them. You can be poor and eaten up with envy, which is kind of like greed by another name. You don't have, but boy, you hate the people that do because they've got what you want. You'd like to bring them down. I'm convinced this is an unsolicited political comment, but I think some percentage of the things that I hear and read about that are being said about us from other countries is sometimes just envy, just sheer raw envy. I'm not excusing our greed because I think we're also guilty of that. But our greed doesn't excuse other people's envy, blaming us for everything that's wrong in the world. I read a book after I got back from the Soviet Union called Russian Journal by a woman who had accompanied her husband over to Moscow University to study for 8 months. It was a fabulously written journal. But she talked about how the Russians were constantly dumping on her for being a materialist capitalist swine, being bourgeois. These are the same Russians that were buying their Nike shoes and designer jeans on the black market. And by the end of her time there, she was finally saying to them, when they would accuse her of being very materialistic, not like them, she commented to them, she says, I never go up and ask you where you got all your clothes. I don't even do that in America. You're the one, she said, who are so preoccupied with fingering all of my belongings and feeling the fabric, and you're completely captivated with what I have. It isn't eating me up as much as it's eating you up. Being poor is no protection from the problem of which Jesus warns right here. Not only that, Jesus had rich friends. He was buried in a rich man's grave. Zacchaeus was a rich man. Jesus never told him to give things away. But once Zacchaeus was transformed, if you know the story, he gave a lot of his money away. What about the joy of giving? The Bible says there's joy attached to that. Some of us may have to take that on faith. That's what Jesus says. And if I don't have anything to give, how can I experience the joy of giving? And here's the real crunch for me and my thinking that I would put to you. If we don't handle the wealth, who will? Who ought to be handling wealth responsibly? Who's going to handle it? Somebody that's consumed with greed or somebody that's living for someone and something bigger than himself? I would like to see some Christians do that. Sometimes Christians get promoted and have to leave Austin and leave our church. I don't like that. But there's another part of me that says, I am excited to see Christians advanced and promoted in places where they can exercise influence in this country and in the marketplace. I will never have an influence in the marketplace directly. That's not my calling. That may be yours or in your neighborhood or in some other sort of arena. Dallas Willard says being poor is one of the worst ways, one of the poorest ways to help the poor. When you don't have anything, you can't do a whole lot for the poor. The only advantage to evil or being poor may be that we have less opportunities to work out evil. That may be the only advantage that you can think of. Now, I'm not saying that sometimes people aren't called to a life of poverty for various reasons. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with being poor. But I'm saying there's nothing wrong with having. Merely having isn't the problem. It's what it does to our hearts. It's our passions, not our possessions, that is the snare of which Jesus warns about here. He says in 1 Timothy 6, if we have food and clothing, we'll be content. People who want to get rich, underline that, want to get rich, are looking for the big score, the lottery, the Vegas kill, the business deal that's too good to be true and really is too good to be true. All of those things are because of this desire to get rich quickly. It says they fall into temptation, a trap. They get into foolish and harmful desires that plunge them into ruin and destruction. It goes on to say the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. It doesn't say money is the cause of all evil. It just says all kinds of evil come out of the love of money. It doesn't say money is the cause of the evil. It says our love of the money is the cause of the evil. So if we have the greed life here and the giving it away life over here as some sort of virtuous thing, I want to suggest the good life. Maybe not the good life the way it looks in those glossy magazines ad, but the good life in God's eyes. The life that Jesus says is being rich towards God. Verse 21 in Luke 12. This is how it will be with anyone who stores up things for himself, but is not rich toward God. And again, verse 18 in 1 Timothy 6, it says, command them to do good and to be rich in good deeds. The good life. I would put that to you. You may have two different people, professions, they're going to have different resources. That's fine. You may have two people in the same profession that have two different resources, and that's fine. You may have a person who has been faithful and responsible but has suffered adversity. Maybe he's from Texas, came here at the wrong time, didn't get out quick enough. It may not even be his fault. Some of those things are in the hands of the providence of God. That's why we ought never to look down on somebody who doesn't have those things. None of us is better than somebody else. We've simply been entrusted with a greater responsibility. Money is not the measure of God's favor. And the solution is being rich towards God. What does it mean? Let me suggest some ideas. It means, first of all, recognizing that God's the owner of everything you have. One of the foolish things about this man is that he's taking credit for making the crops come out of the ground. I want to ask you, who gets the credit for the fact that there wasn't a drought that season? Or there wasn't some sort of insect that came along and ate everything up? Who gets the credit for the fact that those things grow? This rich landowner had absolutely no humility, no sense of gratitude, no sense that, God, you have blessed me. I don't deserve the abundance that you've given me. I thank you. How can I use this to honor you? Because after all, what I have comes from you. Cotton Mather, an old Puritan writer in America a couple hundred years ago, 300 years ago, said this: in our occupations we spread our nets, but it's God who brings into our nets all that comes into them. I like that. Whatever my job, I spread the net, but unless God is the cooperator with me, it isn't going to work. That's why we should be thankful for all we receive. Secondly, not only recognizing God as owner, but remembering that we're accountable to Him. It doesn't take a genius to figure out if somebody else owns it, he's going to want to know what I do with it. If I drive another person's car somewhere, I can't just go around and squeal tires and run this thing into other cars and get in my way on the road because it doesn't belong to me. I'm going to have to answer to the owner for that. And God's the same way. If the financial and material resources you and I have really belong to God, then we're not free to simply go out and just squander them for fun, with emphasis on the word squander. I'm not against fun, I'm against squandering on fun or anything else. We're not at freedom to handle those things carelessly. We can't ignore what we have as long as we don't have any problems. What is it, 90% of people don't have a budget? You have absolutely no idea where God's money and resources are going? Dinkinsy. If God is holding us accountable, we have got to be aware of what we've got and where it's going. Pat Morley tells about a friend of his who sold his company. But he worked out an arrangement where he was allowed to stay on as a branch manager. And anybody on the outside wouldn't have noticed the difference particularly. It looked like the same company and the same personnel were there, and it still ran pretty much the same way. But Pat Morley knew that on the inside it was altogether different. Now he wasn't calling the shots, he was answering to somebody else. The lines of authority, the lines of communication were changed. He was only a branch manager. Part of what it means to become a Christian, it means to be bought out by God. Redeemed. That's what the word redeem means. We need marketplace terms. Bought out by the cross. It means that we recognize God as the owner and we're merely branch managers. Rich fool didn't grasp that. If you count up the word I and my and me, you'll find it in there a dozen times. You won't find him talking about God. That's exactly what people are thinking down inside. Me, 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 me. They're not thinking about God at all. It's ironic, isn't it, that if we lose our shirts, we quote a verse like 1 Philippians 4:13, I can do everything through Christ who strengthens me. But if we have a killing, we don't stop and think, oh, whoa, this is dangerous. I can do everything through Christ who strengthens me. We're too busy thinking about where the catalog is buried and where we can start ordering and what we can start doing with that windfall. We ought to be more worried about success, really, than we are about failure. Thirdly, we need to understand that stewardship means more than mere giving. I'm not asking for funds. That doesn't have anything to do with us today. I'm talking about attitudes toward possessions. Jesus isn't giving a bunch of rules. He's trying to startle us into examining the way we look at what we do all the time anyway, handle material things. To understand that stewardship is more than giving means this. I had a conversation with a businessman recently who told how, as part of his work, he would try to get people into houses and work out mortgage deals for them that were not cost-effective for him at all. He told about one woman way out in West Texas somewhere that was trying to buy a house. It was only $15,000. And it took all kinds of red tape and bureaucratic juggling to make this deal come together. I think he said they spent 3 months putting that together. And when they were done, he'd actually lost $3,000 just trying to get this single parent, this divorced woman, into a home where she would be provided for. And he said that's where the excitement came. It wasn't just those big deals with a stroke of the pen. Those are the things that gave him the resources to be able to provide for those kinds of things. Now, in your arena, there is a bigger goal than the highest score. This isn't just a video game. We ought to be asking, how can I, well, there is a score, but it's different than you think. How can I rack up points for God? How can I be rich towards God in the way I use these things? We live in a world where exploitation and injustice is really real. G.K. Chesterton says, countless acts by millions of self-centered instead of God-centered individuals may reasonably be thought to be destroying the world. Countless little bitty selfish acts add up. And we're to counteract them, Jesus said, to be salt and light in the world, retard the decay, and labor for justice. William Wilberforce, 150 years ago, spent a lifetime over incredible odds eliminating slavery from England. They didn't have a civil war like we did. I know there may have been other things involved, but they didn't go to war. They didn't shed blood among family members to solve the problem because they had Christians that labored. They would spend several hours a day in prayer over a period of 20, 25 years. And when they finally had the final vote, in which England abolished slavery and reimbursed slave owners from the national treasuries, an astonishing act, Wilberforce turned to his friend in the parliament, Henry Thornton, and said, well, Henry, what do we abolish next? That's the kind of spirit. I ought to see that I've been entrusted with opportunities and resources and use those things to honor God. Jesus looked down, we're told. The second person of the Trinity looked down upon the world from heaven, and he didn't think, well, I'm going to send them a Hallmark card because I care enough to send the best and say, keep going, guys. See if you can't just pull it together. I'm really rooting for you. He got dressed, so to speak, in the veil of human flesh and came into the world. He didn't send somebody else to do the job. Sometimes we want to give just in order to get a guilt monkey off our back. Sometimes we are really avoiding the responsibility of personal involvement. I don't know what that means in your arena. I'm just challenging you to think about that. Is God calling you to some great thing in a small place that could have great consequences? Fourthly, we need to accept responsibility for creating wealth. We need Christians who will see their ability, their entrepreneurial skill, as an opportunity to provide means of living for other human beings. See that, really an act of love to manage their companies responsibly so that other people have jobs and are cared for. Christians ought to be in the forefront of that. This man was never criticized in Luke 12 for having big crops. In fact, it was a blessing from God. Never criticized for wanting to build a big barn. You got big crops, you need a big barn, that's fine. What the problem is when he began to talk to himself as though it all existed for him and nobody else. That's where the danger comes. It's not only okay to have wealth, it's mandatory to labor to create it. Let me quote you another Puritan. I know Puritan is a dirty seven-letter word in our culture, but listen to this. If God shows you a way in which you may lawfully get more than you can in another way without wronging yourself or anybody else, if you refuse this and choose the less profitable way, you are crossing up one of the ends of your calling. You're refusing to be God's steward. Did you pick up on that? If you have two options and one is more lucrative than the other, and you don't take the more lucrative one, everything else being equally righteous, it says you are really refusing to be a faithful steward before God. Now that's interesting. To me, that puts a little bit of soul on the concrete in Christianity. That has some grit to it. That's something that doesn't take place in a little spiritual shelter on Sunday morning. That's something that is Monday through Saturday out there in the marketplace. Fifthly, quickly, it means valuing people. It means not looking down on the person who has modest means, who isn't able to dress well, who doesn't drive the right car, and all those kinds of things. And lastly, it means cultivating contentment. Did you pick up on verse 6? Godliness with contentment is very profitable. That's what great gain means. If you want to talk profit, let me tell you it's profitable. It's just being content. If you don't have contentment, it doesn't matter how much you have. It only fuels the discontent. But if you have contentment, he says, now there's a profit we could talk about. We need to be careful that we don't allow ourselves to get ensnared. In fact, in verse 17 of the same passage, it says, we are to put our hope in God who richly provides us with everything for our enjoyment. That's the note I really want to leave you with today, is that affluence per se simply is not wrong from God's perspective. Our attitude toward it is the problem. If our attitude is pure, we can receive those things for enjoyment, not as an end in itself, but simply a byproduct of being God's servant in whatever calling he's put us in. You follow that? It's okay to enjoy those things. In fact, if God gives us a gift and we despise it by not enjoying it or saying it's of no value, then we've really insulted God. Be the same if you gave a gift to somebody and they just kind of threw it away when they walked out the door. Some of us do that with God's gifts. We ought to enjoy those gifts. I read about a man this week who has a job, modest means, but he'd managed to save up money and somebody needed $1,000 and he said he got to give it away. Did you hear that? Got to give away $1,000. He had never been able to do that before. For the first time in his life, he could give $1,000 away. Now there's a benchmark. Steve Turner says, looks aren't everything. Luxury is not everything. Money is not everything. Health's not everything. Success is not everything. Happiness is not everything. Even everything is not everything. There's more to life than everything. That's a poem, and I like it. Maybe one of the reasons Jesus understood this is because when he was in the wilderness being tempted by the devil, you remember that story? One of the temptations was wealth. He understood the seductive power. He also understood the destructive power of greed. His calling was not to be rich in the possessions of this world, but there was never a criticism of those who had that calling from God. We're not all the same, so you can't compare yourself to somebody else. Got to be just between you and God. I guess that's the good news, really, is that I can be in a personal relationship with God that will guide me and one that will sustain me. Because things won't satisfy. Not even other people will satisfy. But He satisfies. That's the way He made me. If I don't really have Him in my life and depending upon Him to meet the deepest needs, then I'm just a person with full barns and empty lives. Let's pray. Father, take these truths and these warnings, but also the challenge to greatness that you put before it and sort it out in our minds. This is a subtle area, difficult to explain, even harder to live, but fraught with great opportunity and excitement. If we've been blessed in great things, help us to see them with new eyes today. If we haven't been, protect us from envy. Help us to be content with what we have, whether it's a lot or a little. Help us to enjoy the things you've given us. Help us, most of all, to be rich towards you, even as you are rich toward us in giving us your only Son. And we ask these things in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.